Okay.
Everybody have a copy of this handout?
Okay. I was going to once again make an attempt to place names to faces, but seeing that we're a couple minutes behind, I may have to wait and do that on Thursday. So again, to assist me, what I would like you to do is keep more or less the same seats you had a couple of weeks ago or a week and a half ago, last time we met, to assist me to make a correlation with what I wrote down. Okay, what I'd like to do today is continue the discussion about time. In doing so, what I'd like to do is to make sure that you have a good understanding of the difference between absolute time and relative time, a topic that I think you discussed with Professor Lohmann last week. So to lead off today's lecture, I'm going to be asking you questions about these terms and what they mean to you, and then very quickly review the geologic time scale. The handout I just gave you has a summary of the geologic time scale. It looks like it's a very involved list of names and so on, but there are a few basic concepts I'm going to point out that you should remember in order to facilitate future discussions. You're not going to have to memorize all the names you see on there. I'm just going to point out the important items in a minute. After we've done that, I am going to, again, ask you some questions about sedimentary units, how they become so extensive as to cover an entire state, or perhaps even a large section of a continent, and partly to answer the questions we're going to ask about stratigraphic correlations, we will go into what are known as transgressions and regressions. So number four is really the answer to number three. And then if time allows, at the very end, I will introduce radioactivity. Okay? So let's begin by revisiting this issue of relative time versus absolute time. Anybody else need a handout? You need one as well? Okay. Okay. Professor Lohmann told me this morning that he talked about relative dating versus absolute dating. And very quickly, I would like somebody to remind us of what relative dating is and actually what it is that it accomplishes. What is relative dating? This is a course about the evolution of the Earth, right? So that means we're going to have to put things or events in their proper sequence. And we can do this either by actually putting a number on the event that this happened 500 million years ago, or we can do it by using relative dating techniques. So what is relative dating?
Is that something is older or younger than something?
Okay, so this is simply to place events in their proper sequence. Okay, all we are doing is putting events in their proper sequence without necessarily saying exactly when those events took place. And one example we could use here is a cross-sectional view of, let's say, a road cut. And you may identify in this road cut that there is some sort of an undulating line that we call a nonconformity. Okay, this is a line along which there's been some erosion take place. You may find that immediately below an unconformity like so, there are a series of intrusions we call dikes. Let's have them represent several different generations. Okay, so let's call this one dike A, and this one is going to be like B. To make it interesting, let's put in third one. Okay, so this is cross-sectional view. We're looking at a road cut, and we see sedimentary layers that are horizontal, like so. Okay, and these sedimentary units have been cut by these intrusions that I'm calling dikes. Okay, so sedimentary layers would look like this. This would be, say, unit 1, 2, 3, and 4. And in fact, you may find that on top of that, there are other sediments deposited. Let's call this unit 6, 7, and 8. Okay, so relative dating is the exercise of placing geologic events in their proper sequence. And if you came across a cross-section like this in a road cut as you traveled to Arizona or New Mexico or a place like that, would you be able to tell me what happened first and what happened second and third and so on? This is a cross-section that has sedimentary units 1 through 8. Those sediments have been cut by these features we call dikes. They are basically igneous material that came up and solidified in features that we call dike. And it happens to be in this case that we have three of them, A, B, and C. We have an unconformity, and we have sedimentary layers on top of that. What we would like to do, therefore, is put a history together, and in doing so, we are going to be carrying out the exercise of relative dating, placing geologic events in their proper sequence.
What yes. happened to 5 or some conformity?
Well, that's part of the story. I purposely omitted number 5 because as we put the history, the geologic history of this cross-section together, you'll have to tell me what happened to number 5. Okay? So what do you think happened first? And yes, Cliff.
I think like that layer 1 sediment was deposited.
Okay.
1 through 4 was deposited.
Okay. So the first thing that happened.
1 through 5 was.
First thing that happened was the deposition of sedimentary layers 1 through 4. Now, we can't be absolutely sure that unit 5 was deposited. And that is an issue I'm going to come back to after we've discussed what this unconformity is. So unit 5 may have been deposited more or less around the same time that 1 through 4 were deposited, but there are some other possibilities that we should consider. But before we do that, what would you say happened next? Yes?
Dike C, B, the A.
Are you Jenny?
Drew.
Drew, excuse me, Drew. Dikes
C, B, then A.
Okay, dikes were then emplaced in that order, C, B, and then A. Okay, so we can say that it was the emplacement.
I didn't know they're in that order.
Oh, dikes. Maybe Drew can tell us how he knows it's that order. C, B, and then A, in that order. Okay, how do you know they were placed in that order, Drew?
Because B overlaps C and then A overlaps B.
Okay, it is because of the concept known as cross-cutting relations. Okay, so this is cross-cutting. Relations, you can see that dike C must have been in place already before dike B was in place. After all, it's truncated by it, or it's cut by it. And you can also see that dike B is cut by dike A. So of the three of them, C has to be the oldest one. It was here when this one came in to cut it. And likewise, B must have been in place before A was in place, because it's cut by A, so A has to be the youngest one. Okay? All right. Then what happens? After these dikes have been in place in this sedimentary sequence, something very dramatic happens. What do you think it is from the evidence you can see? Am I?
Sedimentary layer C. It's placed on top of the.
You mean most sediments were deposited?
The sediment after 1, 2, 4,
yes.
6 was placed.
Okay, you're saying that number 6 is then placed on top of this?
Yeah.
Well, that will happen at some stage, but before we worry about the deposition of unit 6, what I would like us to worry about is what happened along this unconformity. An unconformity being really a surface of discontinuity. In other words, it's a surface along which there has been erosion. But before erosion can take place, okay, let's revisit the issue of deposition. Units 1 through 4 were deposited, let's say, in the ocean. This is a marine sequence, if I didn't mention it already. Can we erode units that are still underwater? Can sediments that happen to be underwater be eroded?
Yes.
They can?
There's a movement of water.
Okay.
Yeah, they can be eroded.
Okay. Now, if we have significant currents in the oceans, yes, sediment can be moved around. But when it is moved around, it goes from one place to the other, all right? And we still have deposition taking place. So in other words, if my ocean basin is like so, and you and I are looking at a cross-section that developed for sediments that sit right here, if we have strong currents, say at sea level, the currents could indeed move some of this sediment from right there and deposit it someplace else where currents are not as strong. But to have a very profound erosion of surface develop, is our mountain or our pile of sediments going to be underwater or exposed to the elements? It has to be exposed, right? In order to develop a significant erosion of surface, our sediments have to be exposed to the elements. In other words, we need rain, we need rivers, we need wind, all of those factors that are going to help weather down or erode the surface so that we develop what is known as an unconformity. So that brings us to the point of what happened to number 5. It could very well be that unit 5 had been deposited along the surface right on top of number 4, but because of the erosion that occurred, unit 5 was removed. But it is also possible that unit 5 was never deposited in the first place. How would we know then that unit 5 ever existed if it wasn't deposited right here? Yes.
It wouldn't be if it was ever deposited, it wouldn't completely erode it away, right?
Okay, what we're saying here really is that we would be comparing the cross-section we're looking at right here to a cross-section we might be able to see in another cliff, let's say 100 kilometers away. So 100 kilometers away, and by the way, that's where we're going to start talking about stratigraphic correlations, we may be able to observe 100 kilometers away units 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 6. That's how we infer that a unit 5 ever existed, because we see it some other place where it was not eroded away. Okay? That's how we know that unit 5 existed, but in this particular location, it has been eroded away. Okay, so having said that, profound amounts of erosion will take place only if these rocks are exposed to the elements, what would you say then happens after the emplacement of dikes A, B, and C? What must happen, Cliff?
The sea comes back, or what, it gets deposited underwater again?
Okay, we need sea level to do something, don't we? Right? In other words, if these rocks are initially underwater, but now we want them to experience a period of erosion, that means that either sea level drops, sea level drop is one possibility. What's the other possibility? What's that?
It's wet in the way.
What's that?
It's eroded
by currents, is that what you're saying? Now, I'd like either sea level to drop so that my rocks become exposed to the surface, so that wind and rain and so on are going to start working on those rocks and erode them away. Or what else can happen? Mountain building processes. Okay, we can have tectonic deformation, exactly. The sediments themselves can be uplifted. And that's what we can summarize as tectonic deformation. Okay, so we either have sea level change, sea level drop, or the land itself came up by tectonic deformation. Either one is going to accomplish the same thing. Okay. Then, it looks like, in order for more marine sediments to be deposited, so let's call these marine sediments, and these as well are marine sediments. Okay, so what happens then in order for us to be able to deposit units 6 through 8? After this surface has been exposed to the elements and weathering, erosion, and so on have taken place, then we have what happening?
Sediments from other areas?
Well, yeah, sediments will eventually come into our basin, but I'm telling you that these are marine sediments, so we really just have to reverse what we're talking about here. So we either have sea level rise, okay, or we are going to have tectonic deformation, in this case, by the way, created uplift, and in this case, tectonic deformation is going to create subsidence. In other words, sinking. The ground sinks, and it goes below sea level yet again, and therefore, we can start depositing new sediments on top of the original units 1 through 4. So number 5 is we have finally the deposition of units 6 through 8. Okay, so the exercise we just went through is one of placing geologic events in their proper sequence, but I haven't really told you exactly when units 1 through 4 were deposited. Okay, that is something we can do through what is known as absolute dating. Okay, so what is absolute dating again? From what Professor Lohmann told you last week? Okay, so putting a numerical value to a geologic event. How can we put a numerical value to a geologic event that this must have happened 53 million years ago? How do we get that number? Okay, radioactive decay. All right, so this absolute dating, as we shall see at the end of today or beginning of next hour, is going to be based on, this is a numerical value, and the numerical value is going to be based on radioactivity. Now, well before radioactivity was discovered, anybody know when radioactivity was discovered? How long ago was that?
1896.
1896, right. 1896 is when radioactivity was discovered. But by that time, geologic mapping had been going on for probably 200, 300 years. Okay, 200 or 300 years. And the geologic mapping that was done early used concepts of relative dating to come up with divisions, and this is where I'm going to mention what I think you should remember. divisions of time that we can cut into sections, like there is a section right in here known as the Cenozoic, a section in here known as the Mesozoic, a section in here known as the Paleozoic, and the earliest time for the Earth known as the Precambrian. What is the word Precambrian? Right there, the Precambrian. Now, it was much, much later, after radioactivity had been discovered, that the values that you see here were added to the geologic time scale. Okay, so this is a recent addition to the time scale, but prior to that, we already knew about the Precambrian, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic. How were these divisions put in place? Okay, that's the question we should ask ourselves now. Well, the geologic time scale, okay, the most important thing I can tell you about the geologic time scale is based on profound changes in life forms. If you walk your way from the Colorado River up this section of the Grand Canyon, you will discover that close to the river, you're seeing very primitive life forms. Halfway up the section, as you come out of the canyon, you will discover that you're beginning to see things that you recognize in these life forms. And then near the very top, just about everything you see is something that still exists today. For that reason, the Paleozoic is known as early life. Okay, the word Paleozoic means early life. And among the creatures of the Paleozoic, can anybody think of one? What was the dominant life form of the Paleozoic? This would have been 530 to 244-45 million years ago. What was the dominant life back then? There were a few fish in the oceans, but the dominant life form was actually amphibians. Okay, this is before the emergence of reptiles. So this time segment in here is dominated by amphibians. Mesozoic, everybody has seen Jurassic Park. Okay, so from that you'd be able to tell me that this time horizon in here is dominated by reptiles. And Cenozoic, which means recent life, is dominated by mammals like you or me. Okay? Now, I would like you to remember those three terms, Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic. The reason being that later on in our discussions, we will need to know what they are. I'll simply tell you life forms of the Mesozoic, and you should know what Mesozoic means. If you want to, you can remember exactly when each one of these ends, but it's not absolutely necessary. The Paleozoic begins 530 million years ago, ends 245 million years ago, and everybody has probably seen these doomsday movies about asteroids bombarding the Earth and so on. Well, we think that one may have happened 66 million years ago, when the dinosaurs go extinct. In other words, many reptiles go extinct at this particular time, and mammals become the dominant life form subsequently. The only other thing I'd like to remember about the geologic timescale is that 90% of geologic time is actually squeezed into just the bottom right here. Okay, so 90% of geologic time, keep in mind that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, 4.6 billion years old, but 90% of the existence of the Earth, of time for the existence of the Earth, is something we don't know very much about, and so we put it more or less under the rug, way down here, and most of what we know about evolution and so on is since 530 million years ago. Now, has anybody worried about how we know the age of the Earth? How do we know that the Earth is actually 4.6 billion years old? Yes?
Don't you assume that all the whole universes or all the other space where we have the same time, and then they find the age of the rocks?
OK, Okay, so this is an assumption that she's pointing out that we'll come back to a little bit later. We have to make an assumption about the age of all the objects in the solar system. Our Earth has been churned around so that the rocks that existed on its surface initially are no longer there. Okay, those rocks have disappeared. They've gone inside the interior of the Earth, so that we have to make the assumption that all the other bodies in the solar system that haven't undergone this churning of the surface formed at the same time as the Earth did. And we'll be evaluating that assumption when we come to that discussion in another few lectures from now. Okay, so this age for the Earth, 4.6 billion years, is really based on dating meteorites. Okay, these objects that come flying through space and fall right here on Earth are the ones we use to date the Earth, or dating the solar system in general, and we'll be evaluating that a little bit later on. So most of what we know about geologic time comprises only about 10% of the entire history of the Earth. That's very, very important. Any questions about this? Yes.
I read that the rock found on the moon.
Yes.
It's used to help date the age of the Earth.
Right, right. And you know, this churning I'm talking about, where the surface of the Earth renews itself probably every 200 million years or thereabouts, every rock on the surface has pretty much disappeared, in the ocean basins, that is. On the moon, on the other hand, there is absolutely no movement of any crustal blocks, so that the earliest rocks to form on the moon are still on its surface. And when you date rocks on the moon, the oldest ones are about 4.4 billion years old. So they're not exactly 4.6, which is what we are claiming the age of the Earth to be, but they are awfully close to the age of the Earth. So the oldest rocks on the moon are about 4.4 billion years. And in fact, if you look at our syllabus, you'll discover that we're going to talk about the origin of the moon, and one of the issues we're going to be addressing at that time is why the moon is slightly younger than what we think the age of the solar system to be. Okay? Another comment? Yes?
No, that the moon hasn't been changing since creation.
That it hasn't been churning its surface? Well, partly because we find very old rocks on its surface, but also because it's so small. Okay? Because it is so small, it is not able to sustain convection in its interior to be able to destroy its original crust. So its original crust is still there, still preserved. And that is a topic that we're going to address in detail when we talk about the origin of the moon in another few lectures. Now, another topic I'd like to bring up, which as I said a moment ago, was very influential in putting the geologic time scale together. Okay, remember that in identifying recent life, middle life and early life, correlations were being made over very large distances. And on the handout I gave you, the example I would like to use is of sedimentary layers, very much like the ones we drew in our cross-section over there. But in this case, we're looking at northern Colorado. I found this convenient to show you because an oil company went and drilled five holes right here in northern Colorado over a distance of about 150 kilometers. They put in five different holes and discovered the following. There's hole number one. They went all the way down to whatever that is, 100 meters or so, perhaps deeper than that. And they found a sandstone layer there. They found a shale right there. And they found this formation that I colored in yellow right there. Then they moved about, 30, 40 kilometers away, put another hole in the ground, and discovered exactly the same relationships they had seen over here, and repeated that five times, and you can see this orange unit appears in all five holes, and the yellow unit likewise appears in all five holes. Does that bother anybody? That you can actually find a unit like a sandstone shown in orange over a distance of 150, 200, perhaps even 1,000 kilometers. The reason I ask you whether it bothers you or not is the following. Okay, this is something I've given you as well. If you ever stood at the waterfront, at the beach, where sediment comes into a standing body of water like the ocean, you would be the first one to tell me that right next to the beach here, it is not a terribly wide zone over which we are depositing very coarse grains of sand and pebbles and cobbles and so on. Okay, so if we take a picture that is an instant in time, what we discover is that in areas where sediments are deposited, we have a very narrow zone over which coarse sediment is going to be deposited. And if we go in slightly deeper waters, it's a very narrow zone over which sand is being deposited. And in deeper waters, a very narrow zone over which mud or mudstone eventually is being deposited. So the question I'm asking you is, how do we go from very local deposition of sediments in a zone that's no more than a kilometer or so in width to having such a unit actually cover an entire state? Anybody see what the problem is here? Okay, the oil wells that we just drilled in northern Colorado show us that a sandstone unit can actually exist all the way from the Utah border to the Nebraska border. This is a very, very wide area. And yet, when we look at environments in which sediments are being deposited today, we see that any given unit, like a sandstone or a conglomerate, is being deposited over just a very narrow belt. And my question to you is, how do we go from having sediments deposited in a very narrow area to having that particular sediment cover an entire state? How does that happen? Yes?
Conditions were different.
In what sense? It's going to have to do with conditions. Yes, you're right.
As far as like,
conditions are changing, but in what way? Drew?
Maybe it was not covered by ocean.
Okay, what did the ocean do? I mean, what you're saying is if we have an ocean that's rather extensive, okay, it will still have a beach somewhere. And what I'm pointing out is, well, let's take the example of the eastern seaboard of the United States. Okay, there is Florida. New York City is over here somewhere, Long Island. What I'm pointing out here is that we are depositing sand over a very narrow strip, if we assume that all of this is beach from New York to Florida. So it's a very, very narrow belt. How do we go from having sediments deposited over such a narrow belt to actually covering several states like so, as I showed you in the example of Colorado? Yes?
Glaciers?
What did the glaciers do?
They carried sediments.
They're going to do it locally. Okay, they're going to do it locally. When we talk about the sediments you find in, let's say, the Grand Canyon, you know, if this is a map of the United States, the Four Corners area, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and Utah, are all covered by more or less the same sediments. Okay, it's a very, very large area, and glaciation had nothing to do with it. So you're kind of beating around the bush. You said conditions will change, the oceans, you're all mentioning the right things. But in what way specifically did the ocean change? If you want to cheat a little bit, you can look on the next page that I handed you. Okay, the answer to this question, or the answer to this riddle, has to do with the fact that sea level is not invariant. It actually changes through time. Okay, so the image I just showed you a moment ago of having a beach along which we're depositing sand, this image right here, is just a snapshot. If you came back 1,000 years from now, sea level would not be where you see it today. That is illustrated by these two diagrams right here, where in the first diagram, we can see that the shoreline is right there. And if we fast forward in time, we can see that the shoreline has moved to over here. Okay, so in the first image, the new shoreline would be somewhere over here. And that is because sea level has risen. Or you could also argue that the basin in which these sediments are being deposited has gone down. So the idea of shorelines moving inland from where we find them to be today is known as transgression. Transgression is the movement of the shoreline inland from where they are at any given time. And regression is the opposite. Okay, that would be shoreline moving away from the continents. Okay, so if shorelines can transgress, in other words, they can move inland, what is that going to do to where we're depositing sediments? And what does that have to do with sediments being able to cover a very, very large area, such as several different states? In other words, I'm asking you to compare picture A to picture B. Okay, what happens when the shoreline transgresses, moving inland? Let's see, I have a pointer right here. Let's consider a particular point such as right here. This is a depositional environment that early on, you can see, is ideal for depositing fairly large pieces of rocks so that the rock that's going to form is known as a conglomerate in that particular area. But now the shoreline changes, in other words, sea level has gone up, and the area that we were monitoring before, which is right there, corresponding to right there, is now in deeper waters. And you can see that where before we were depositing fairly large sediment, we are now depositing fairly fine sediment. Okay, do you appreciate that? So in other words, we've changed the depth of the water at that particular locality. And whereas previously it was ideal for conglomerate to accumulate, now, after the shoreline has moved inland, that particular point is at a deeper water than previously, so we are depositing sand. Well, imagine the shoreline being able to move even further inland. In other words, that basin is either sinking or sea level is rising very, very rapidly, and therefore this particular unit being able to form a very, very large area that keeps going on and on and on for several hundreds of kilometers inland. So typically, therefore, what we would find is what is known as a transgressive sequence of sediments. In a transgressive sequence of sediments, what you're likely to find as a package is that at the very bottom, you're going to have conglomerate. Okay, immediately above that, you're going to have sand-sized material. So the rock is a sandstone. And immediately above that, you'll have fine-grained material. The rock is a shale. And then finally, you'll have a limestone. Now, if you're hiking into the Grand Canyon and you look in these cliffs, and you see conglomerate, then you see sandstone, then you see shale, then you see limestone, you can actually begin to tell us what sea level was doing when those sediments were being deposited. You can be reasonably sure that when those sediments were being deposited, sea level was rising. Okay, because we've just demonstrated that right here. Again, to continue with the example I was provided before, the first rock to be deposited for this particular locality was what turned out to be conglomerate. Sea level rose so that right above conglomerate we deposited sand, later to become sandstone. And you can imagine that if I raise sea level even more to this level right here, eventually, at that particular locality, water will be so deep that I can't deposit sand there anymore, but instead, this unit right here is going to match inland, and it will be deposited on top of that. So I'll have this sequence of conglomerate, sandstone, and then on top of that, I'll have shale, very much like we've illustrated here. Okay, does everybody get that? You can have transgressions that actually cover hundreds and hundreds of square kilometers, so that eventually you might have sediments that cover almost half a continent. Yes, Emma.
So the different types of rocks have been deposited.
Yes.
Due to their suitability to the environment.
Exactly. Right. What we deposit in any one location is going to be a function of how far we are from the shoreline. In other words, how high sea level happens to be in that particular locality. Okay? So eventually, over geologic time, keep in mind that we're talking about millions and millions of years, you will build a transgressive sequence like the sediments we find in the Grand Canyon today that are not just randomly distributed, but there is indeed a systematic order to what you see, and that represents sea level rising. Now, this invites the other question, okay, of if sediments are deposited during sea level drop, what order should they exist in? As we look at a stratigraphic column very much like this one, but those sediments happen to have been deposited when sea level was going down, what order should they exist in? Again, it's something you can figure out by looking at a column, by looking at a cross section like this. Okay, now let's say that, well, let's begin with this unit right here. It's a shale. Okay, word is right there. If sea level drops so that now sea level is right here, what's going to be deposited on top of the shale? It should be sandstone, right? Because the water is going to be now relatively shallow, so that the environment here will be ideal for sandstone. And if we drop sea level even further, what should be deposited on top of the sandstone? Conglomerate. So really, for regressive sequences, you should simply flip this upside down, and you'll see conglomerate on top, sandstone, shale, and then limestone is going to be at the very bottom. But why is it then that when we go into the Grand Canyon, it's very common to find transgressive sequences like this, but it is not common to find regressive sequences? Why would that be? I mean, you should be able to figure this out. It's easy to find transgressive sequences in any sedimentary pile you look at anywhere in the world, but it's very rare to find a regressive sequence preserved. Cliff?
It got eroded away.
Okay, why?
Because after the sea regressed, it was exposed to the elements again.
Right, exactly. Okay, notice that during transgression, the sediments being deposited are immediately covered up by others, by younger sediments, so that there's a much better chance of that section being preserved in the geologic record than it is if sea level is dropping. If sea level is dropping, the moment you deposit something like this sand right in here, okay, and then sea level went to down here, well, those loose sediments are immediately exposed and they're going to be eroded away. So regressive sequences are not very common in nature because very shortly after deposition of the sediments, they are eroded away. simply eroded away. Okay, anybody have a question about that? Transgressions and regressions? So basically, sediments exist as a unit over very long distances because of sea level transgression. And in fact, I think I give you a couple of examples to finish off here. One example is a modern example of sea level transgression, which the Netherlands are experiencing today. Okay, so I have a couple of cross sections here. On top, we're looking at the North Sea. And here is the Netherlands, or Holland, right here. And you can see that 400 BC, so that this is a mere 2,400 years ago, the shoreline was actually right here in the Netherlands. And at the present time, the shoreline has moved to way over here. This is why the Dutch have to build these dikes in order to keep sea level from inundating their land. Okay, the shoreline used to be there. Now it has matched all the way to here. And you can see that in a place where previously sand was being deposited, that's what these little dots are, the water now is so deep that mud is what's being deposited. So on top of sandstone, we are now having shale being deposited. And when you go north of there to the Scandinavian countries, you see exactly the opposite. Okay, so let's see, where was sea level at, let's see, where does this go? 6,000 BC, the shoreline was way over here. Okay, and at the present time, the shoreline is right there. So it has actually retreated. So in other words, sea level happens to be dropping in Scandinavia. How would we explain that? See if we have a map to show the region we're talking about here. Okay, there is Great Britain. So the Netherlands would be somewhere in here, and here is Scandinavia. So the area we're talking about is actually not very large, right? Holland over here, Scandinavia over here. We're saying that sea level has gone up over here, sea level has gone down over here. How could that be? How could it be that sea level is doing two different things, not very far from each other, those two localities? How could that be?
Different rock formations.
Can you think of anything that has happened in the last, say, 15, 20,000 years that might be influencing what we're looking at here? Last 15,000 years or so? 15,000 years ago, could we have had the University of Michigan right here? Why not? There were glaciers, okay? There was about 3 kilometers of ice right where you're sitting. Okay. Very, very thick ice. And certainly, there was a tremendous amount of glaciation in the Scandinavian countries. And believe it or not, when you have several kilometers of ice sitting on top of the crust, it depresses the rocks. Very much like putting a big chunk of rock on a sponge. Okay, the sponge is depressed downwards. Rocks that form the crust can likewise be depressed. And after the glaciation has gone away, Scandinavia happens to be rebounding, very much like a sponge would rebound. And guess what happens to Holland over here? When this rebounds, it's almost like pulling on a handkerchief or a shirt. You can see that a moat has to build around this topographic high. Okay, so Scandinavia is going up, and all the area around Scandinavia has to be going down. This is known as isostatic rebound. Re-equilibration, isostatic rebound. Okay, so it is not that the North Sea is changing its sea level. What is actually happening is that over here, the land is going down, and over here in Scandinavia, the land is going up as a result of glacial rebound. And so we've run out of time. The final page on the handouts is just an illustration of a transgressive sequence in the Grand Canyon. Okay, and of course you'll notice that we have sands at the bottom, then shale, then limestone, very much like we've just described over here. Okay, on Thursday I'll begin by describing or defining exactly what radioactivity is, and we can continue on from there. See you Thursday.
I
had a slight delay, so I'll do that. You're David Chen. Okay. All right.